This is The Book and the Spade, a report on the latest discoveries and developments in biblical archaeology. Here's your host, Gordon Govier.
One of the largest and earliest excavations that gets started every dig season in Israel is at Shiloh, or Tel Shiloh, about 19 miles north of Jerusalem. We're doing what has developed into an annual update on this excavation with Scott Stripling, provost of the Bible Seminary in Katy, Texas, president of the Near East Archaeological Society, and director of excavations for the Associates for Biblical Research at Tel Shiloh. I noticed that you had about 120 people volunteering this year, and you also had a celebration celebrating 100 years of excavations.
Unfortunately, when the tensions, you know, leading up to the war broke out, we lost half of our volunteer base. So we were thrilled to still have 120, but we had 240 before that. We work with whatever we've got, and you know, that's the way we roll.
Sounded like you accomplished quite a bit, but tell me a little bit about the celebration first.
Well, 1922 is when the Danish first did their sondages, their probes, but 1926 was the first full season of excavation. It was Age Schmidt and then Hans Kier, who led those early Danish digs. And of course, they were interested in Shiloh for the same reasons that we are today, the record of the biblical tabernacle having been there. Of course, Edward Robinson had surmised that Kirbet Siloun was indeed Shiloh. So the Danish did this early work. And before it was over, they uncovered a church that had an inscription within it that said, "Lord Jesus, bless the people of Shiloh." And so we had that fortunate situation where there's actually an inscription that verified the site. Yeah, 100 years of excavation at Biblical Shiloh.
Did you have some people from Denmark there to celebrate with?
We didn't this year. We normally do. The Danish Biblical Archaeology Society normally brings a team every year, but because of the war, their State Department gave them, you know, travel warnings and stuff like that. In 2022, there was a conference at Shiloh, and we honored them and told their story and so forth on the 100th anniversary of those original sondages.
Well, I did see a news release that indicated three major points for this year's excavation. The first one was this monumental building that we've talked about in our past interviews. Last year, you were just still a little bit uncertain about the dimensions of this building, but it seems like you've got that figured out now.
We hope so. We've got more clarity than we had before the season, for sure. And it's funny that, you know, you got that press release, and you're only the second journalist or reporter that actually reached out to me. But hundreds of stories have been run based off of this press release. But what I said and what they heard were two different things. You know, what we said in the press release is we think we have found the missing wall from the monumental building that we theorized could have been the building of the tabernacle. What they heard is we found the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah.
And of course, that created quite a stir.
Ever since Indiana Jones, the Ark of the Covenant has been super big in archaeology.
Yeah, it is. And I understand why. Some of it's clickbait, but you know, in today's world, there's kind of a feeding frenzy. But to your point, the monumental building is important. It's big. It's substantial. We've been digging it now for a number of years. We're down into the foundation trenches where we can accurately date it. We can see three phases within the building. So it's really substantial. And either it's the building of the tabernacle that we know from the Mishnah in three places and from the biblical text that a permanent structure was built, or it coincidentally has similar dimensions and it's east-west and it dates to the same time period. So it's big, it's important, and it has cultic material within it.
Well, most people think of the tabernacle in terms of the tent rather than a building.
Yeah, you see in 1 Samuel 4 where the language changes, or chapter 3, I'm sorry, where the language changes from temporary to permanent. You're not reading about the curtains, now you're reading about the walls and the doors and so forth. So the language clearly changed, and commentators picked up on that 100 years ago. They've been mentioning this in commentaries that it seems like a permanent structure was built at Shiloh. Then we have the Zevayim 14:6 and the Seder Olam 8 that also state that a permanent structure was built at Shiloh with a tent over the top as a roof, sort of a quasi-tabernacle tent structure.
So, in all fairness to the sensationalizing of the news release this year, that is where the Ark of the Covenant was located.
Well, that's, I'm not saying it's not cool. I'm just saying I didn't claim that we had found it. You know, every language that you can imagine has run some story that looks like we have found the Ark of the Covenant. I think if we're right about this, it's really important. The place where the Ark of the Covenant was and where God self-identifies, Jeremiah 7:12, where I first caused my name to dwell there, that's big stuff. And so we don't have to stretch it as if we have found the Ark of the Covenant. Just the place where it was for 3 centuries is really big news.
And then it moved on eventually to Jerusalem. One of the things I read is, you know, I guess you could consider this the original Israelite capital before Jerusalem.
That's usually the terminology that I will use. I mean, it's not a traditional capital. It wasn't a civil administration that was operated from there. But as far as a place where people looked for governance and decisions, yes. I mean, Joshua did the administration of the tribal allotments from Shiloh. And so, yeah, I think that's a fair way to put it.
You just joined us. We're talking with Scott Stripling about the 2026 excavations at Shiloh in Israel. We're just talking about the monumental building. One of the other news release items was the gate complex that we've talked about for several years now after its discovery. That was also a pretty major discovery. In this year's news release, or maybe in our interview last year, we talked about a bent access gate with multiple rooms. And when you talk about multiple rooms, all of a sudden I'm starting to think about a Solomonic type of gate, which would have come much later. How is this different from the Solomonic gate?
Well, it's different in the sense that we're not talking about that classic three chambers on one side, three chambers on the other. We're talking about an outer gate area that then bends into an inner gate with a single chamber on the left and a single chamber on the right. So, different configuration, different number of chambers. Very significant, though. Probably what I did not put in the press release, the most important or significant thing is the Danish excavation that we were just bragging about. Guess where they put their dump pile 100 years ago?
On the gate.
Not knowing that it was
And
the gate, you've got these massive dump piles and terraces that were built on top of them. We deal with pandemics, Gordon, and with wars and all kinds of situations, you know, that we have to deal with. But I've tried to organize for 3 years some heavy equipment to come and move the dump piles out so we wouldn't have to spend years excavating through their dump. We finally got that done this year. With that removed, we'll eventually wet sift it all and make sure there's nothing, you know, important that may have been in the dump. But now we're going back next year with a plan of how to finish this excavation of the gate complex with that dump out of the way.
because you've kind of established a reputation as somebody who goes after the dump piles to see what they missed the first time around.
I can't resist it. And since we've had such good success, I definitely want to check this one too.
We'll be looking forward to our interview next year to find out more about the gate at Shiloh. And this gate's important because that's part of the biblical story.
Well, that's right. The elder sat on the gate of the city. And in the Bible, we have a specific mention that Eli is in the gate of the city when his life comes to an end. I mean, he falls over backward and dies in the gate. The Ark of the Covenant has been captured at Ebenezer. His worthless sons, Hophni and Phinehas, have been killed at Ebenezer. His daughter-in-law is in labor and is giving birth, and then he falls over and dies. So it is a watershed moment. And interesting that the Bible mentions a death in the gate at Shiloh. I was reading in my Bible a month or two ago about the death of Jezebel. So she's pushed out of a balcony and they don't bury her. It says they left her body in the streets and then the dogs came and ripped her body apart. And I thought, wow, if Eli wasn't buried, I wonder if the same thing happened. This got me thinking because the only human bone we've ever found at Shiloh is right there in the gate area. It's disarticulated. There's a finger and a rib and parts of a cranium and parts of a fibula, as if animals had disarticulated this body. Now, I don't know that that's Eli's body, but I'm hoping to do radiocarbon dating on those bones, and it would be very interesting if they dated to about 1075 BC.
Well, that loss of the Ark of the Covenant at Ebenezer is the connection that I have to your work at Shiloh, because Tel Aphek is right near Ebenezer. That's where the battle took place with the Philistines, and that's where I excavated as a volunteer way back many years ago.
Wow.
It's a nice connection. There's always good biblical connections to dig into. So we talked about the monumental building and the gate complex, and that leaves the Favissa, the third major area, Area D, that you've been excavating and making a lot of progress. You found a lot of bones there.
We sure have. I'm considering going into the bone business. One of the most interesting things about those bones is that I have dozens of radiocarbon dates from them. And when the Barillon excavation in the 1980s first discovered the Favissa, they did zero radiocarbon dating of anything, of olive pits or bones or anything. And so it was sort of their ceramic analysis that they based the date on. They had it from about 1550 to about 1400 was their window for this Favissa. I felt like they were off by about a century from my reading of the pottery, but so my word against theirs. So it was important to me. Of course, I have a fantastic ceramic typologist, Lior Freud, for that time period, who's working with me. I have a zoo archaeologist on staff also to make sure that we analyze the bones correctly. The dating from the bones, radiocarbon dates, have come back spot on LB2A. It was what I had thought. It was about 100 years later. And so it synchronized really nicely with what I had thought and also with the biblical date. Now I just sent off last week 25 more radiocarbon samples. And so we'll, see if we get the confirmations we're looking for. Interestingly, and you probably saw this in the media also, they found these three storage jars that came to light underneath the Favisa. We wanted to see where bedrock was. And it's a good thing I'm not a betting man because I thought it would be about a half meter down. We went 2 to 2.5 meters further down. About a meter and a half down, we began to encounter the storage jars. So we were careful not to damage them. They were broken, but they were intact. We removed all the debris from the square and ultimately excavated the squares. Now, the funny thing is, at the beginning of the day, I said to Jordan, "Don't even bother coming back for lunch today if you don't bring me burned olive pits, Jordan." Because I wanted them for radiocarbon dating. What does he do at the end of the day? He brings me about 500 burned olive pits. Two of the jars, it turns out, because we have an archaeobotanist on site. We used to wait a year for these types of results. And so with an archaeobotanist on site, I know immediately two jars are full of olives, one is full of lentils, which makes a lot of sense. These jars date from the Middle Bronze Age, the Canaanite period. Above that was the Favisa. So now we can see the entire cross-section profile of what was going on in Area D.
Scott Stripling is the provost of the Bible Seminary in Katy, Texas, the president of the Near East Archaeological Society, and the director of excavations for Associates for Biblical Research at Tel Shiloh. That's the site the Bible says was the home of the Ark of the Covenant and the virtual capital of Israel for 300 years before Jerusalem. There's more to report on the 2026 excavations at Tel Shiloh. We'll continue that conversation in our next program. The Israel Antiquities Authority provides breaking news videos on new discoveries, and we are featuring three of those videos and two other recent productions at our website at radioscribe.com. There you can also find information on how to subscribe to Artifacts, our biblical archaeology news magazine. That's at radioscribe.com. I'm Gordon Govier. Thanks for tuning in. Join us again next time for more backgrounders on the Bible through biblical archaeology on The Book and the Spade.
The Book and the Spade is produced by Scribe Media. For information on biblical archaeology resources or obtaining a copy of this program on CD, go to our website at radioscribe.com.